You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
To stop the advance on our bill, I've directed our military to take targeted strikes against ISIL terrorist convoys should they move toward the city.
America goes back to war after a fashion in Iraq. James Boyes and Robert Fox will be joining me in the first half of today's show to discuss this and the rest of the day's news. We'll also talk to our man in Belgrade and review the week's new films.
People were so emotionally involved. There was a dream that the town had. It was our dinosaur. It was our lives that had been torn to pieces.
And we'll speak to the author Lawrence Gonzalez about his new book about the human and mechanical aspects of air disasters. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. A lot to get through in the next 58 and a half minutes or so, but ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
US warplanes have today bombed Islamist fighters marching on Iraq's Kurdish capital. Islamic State fighters who have beheaded and crucified captives in their drive to eradicate unbelievers have advanced to within a half hour's drive of Arbil, a hub for US oil companies. President Obama had earlier authorized the strikes, arguing action was needed to halt the Islamist advance. Well, Zayd al-Ali is the author of the book The Struggle for Iraq's Future. He said that neighboring countries like Turkey had a more important role to play than Iran.
Well, the first thing that Turkey could do is that they could make it more difficult for ISIS militants to circulate so freely in their territory. I mean, that's been a major mystery for many people who've been following this over the past few years. In terms of what Iran could do, it's very unclear because Iran will not be able to send in significant fighting forces into Iraq because they would not want to create divisions within the Iraqi Shia community. That would necessarily happen if there were significant ground forces in Iraq.
The Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said on Friday that the government has prepared a list of sanctions which target 172 citizens from Russia and other countries and 65 Russian companies who were financing, as he put it, terrorism in Ukraine. He also said he had addressed leaders of Western countries, urging them to stop supplying Russia with weapons. Israel has launched airstrikes across the Gaza Strip on Friday in response to Palestinian rockets after Egyptian-mediated talks failed to extend a 72-hour truce in a month-long war. Egypt later called for a resumption of the ceasefire, saying only a few points remained to be agreed. Well, Yiftah Kuriel is from the Israeli embassy here in London. He said that Palestinian demands for the border to be reopened into Gaza will be agreed by Tel Aviv, but Hamas is the key obstacle.
After Israel left Gaza, Gaza was totally opened. It was under control of the Palestinian Authority with European Union supervision of the borders. These are the sorts of initiatives that we are looking at now and that are accepted by the international community. But Hamas, a terror group which is importing weapons from Iran and has done so for the past years, is not going to control the borders of Gaza.
Afghanistan's rival presidential candidates, the former finance minister Ashraf Ghani and the former foreign minister Abdullah Abdullah, have today signed a deal to cooperate on the formation of a government of national unity, following meetings with the US Secretary of State John Kerry. Countries around the world have been put on alert as the World Health Organization declares the Ebola outbreak in West Africa an international public health emergency. 961 people have now died since the outbreak began in February. In Nigeria, where more cases of Ebola have been reported, officials say the whole world is at risk. Turgor McIntosh is the vice president of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States.
The Commission is very grieved and saddened that the virus is spreading like wildfire in our community. And this community I'm talking about within the West African community. It is spreading like wildfire. And we are very much grieved and saddened at that.
And finally, in Washington, D.C., a toddler has just squeezed through the White House gates, causing a brief security lockdown on Pennsylvania Avenue and amusing White House reporters awaiting for late breaking news on Iraq. The Secret Service joked that they were going to wait until the baby had learnt to talk to question him, but in the meantime, he was being allowed to go home with his parents. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Thank you, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is now 18.06. That's 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news. Here in the studio, we have the political historian James Boyes, author of Clinton's Grand Strategy, a forthcoming book about American foreign policy under Bill Clinton, and Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard. Welcome back to Midori House to you both. We will start in Iraq, where earlier today, American warplanes have been in action for the first time since America withdrew combat troops in 2011. This morning, two FA-18s targeted an artillery position belonging to the Islamic State, the current name of the insurgency, which has gobbled up swathes of northwestern Iraq in recent weeks and has reached the borders of Kurdistan. There have been reports of subsequent strikes against IS positions as well. Here's President Barack Obama speaking earlier.
To stop the advance on Erbil, I've directed our military to take targeted strikes against ISIL terrorist convoys should they move toward the city. We intend to stay vigilant and take action if these terrorist forces threaten our personnel or facilities anywhere in Iraq, including our consulate in Erbil and our embassy in Baghdad. We're also providing urgent assistance to Iraqi government and Kurdish forces so they can more effectively wage the fight against ISIL.
President Obama speaking earlier. James, seeing as how you've just finished writing a whole great big book about American foreign policy, I'll come to you first.
Thank you.
America has now been bombing Iraq for 23 years. Will they get it right this time?
Well, you know, it's just incredible, isn't it? These fighter jets that you were talking about actually took off from, are you ready for this? The USS George H.W. Bush aircraft carrier. It couldn't get more poetic. Various presidents give names to their grand strategies. We've had containment, for example. Bill Clinton had engagement and enlargement. Robert and I were talking previously. Maybe this is the half-assed doctrine, quite frankly, if I can say that on air. I think there's worse ways of describing that. What is US grand strategy at the moment? There isn't one, quite frankly. This administration basically has been looking to get out of these engagements. I'm quite sure Barack Obama cannot actually believe he's standing at the American presidential podium announcing airstrikes on Iraq of all places. It's the last place he wants to be. He desperately wants to disengage, as he has done throughout a series of locales. He's really finding, I think, it's very, very difficult to be withdrawing in what is going to be a very tough political year for him and his Democratic Party.
Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard, you will know better than most people what Barack Obama is potentially about to learn, that it's an awful lot easier to send your forces into a theatre of battle than it is to get them back out again. How carefully will America be trying to limit its involvement this time?
Well, that's part of the half-assed policy. It's limit, 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 limit.
It's official.
The doctrine, as I think we should call it.
Are you listening, Tea Party? This is what Obama is saying, but I absolutely take James's point. The backup announcement to this, thinking of where Obama has tried to get himself and where he is, the backup announcement was made by Secretary of State John Kerry, who was in Kabul, trying to get a settlement so that America can get out of Afghanistan. He has also, this is the Secretary of State, had to address Gaza, which is not going at all well, and the US of A doesn't have a lever on it.
Yep.
Plus the fact, on their watch today, very responsibly and soberly, Mrs. Margaret Chan, the Director General of the World Health Organization, has announced that this Ebola epidemic is of global ramification.
Which we shall also be coming to. It is something of a full dance card.
It's all interconnected.
But then you get... it's very interesting listening to Obama last night. Why might he, and it was very hypothetical, he knew he was going to have to, actually, have to order strike jets. He was going to have to order them to protect Erbil where there are US diplomatic personnel. Now, is that weak or is that weak? That, as exactly as James has said, that smacks of no strategic concept. By the way, for once, where he is losing the plot a bit, I think, Obama has lost the sense of being a global communicator. If you're such an American leader, Clinton was brilliant at it. Ronald Reagan, in his own way, wasn't at all bad at it. You could address the domestic audience. Mm-hmm. You could address the metropolitan audience. You could address the cosmopolitan audience, friend and foe. And those two gentlemen, particularly Clinton and Reagan, really could do that. Obama, who was a fantastic speaker, a terrific university debater, very much the academic lawyer with an amazing popular touch, which won him the election, has lost it. He's not communicating. He is certainly not sounding like the leader of any Western world, let alone what is left working of the NATO alliance.
I want to pick up on a point you've made there, Robert, which is that he's been very careful to frame this as quite a narrow exercise in defending American interests in Erbil, where, of course, they do have people. They have political, strategic and military and economic interests in Erbil. There is another side to this, though, and I did want to come back to you about this, James, having sure. written about Clinton, mm-hmm. and that is the airdrops which have been dispatched by both the US Air Force and the Royal Air Force to help these somewhat beleaguered Yazidi peoples. You will have thought about this a lot putting your book together. To what extent is any American president haunted by Bill Clinton's failures in Rwanda and Bosnia? To what extent was Obama haunted by the idea that he might end up being remembered as somebody who waved through another genocide?
Crikey. Well, it's fascinating you use that exact word, because until you did, I was going to start saying, well, there's a whole big backstory to Rwanda and Bosnia, and you have to include Somalia in that. And,
indeed.
And European Union insistence, of course, that it was the hour of Europe, not the hour of America, that kept the Bush administration out of this before we moved into Bill Clinton. It's fascinating that at the podium last night, Obama raised the G word, genocide. Your listeners might recall that when Rwanda was happening in 1994-95, the White House specifically refused to use the G word.
Because the G word has serious legal implications.
Absolutely. Because as soon as you trigger that and say it's happening, you trigger this idea that there has to be an international response to it, in theory at least. So they talked about acts of genocide. The fact that Obama, as Robert rightly pointed out, this constitutional lawyer, has come up and said the G word. I hope he knows what he's saying. I worry that he doesn't. Time and time again, Robert rightly said that Obama can give a great speech. Those great speeches, I have to point out, are always off auto cue. And when he's standing at the podium, talking off the top of his head, that's when he makes mistakes. When he talks about red lines in Syria, he may well have made one with regard to issuing the use of the word genocide from an American legal point of view, I fear.
Robert, the analogy with Syria, I think, is absolutely fair. Because both in the case of Obama, as big as to little, or rather like a penny farthing bicycle, both Cameron and Obama, and I'm talking about the crisis of last August, of which this is a very strong echo, is that they talked about red lines, they talked about actions, and in neither of their initial pronouncements, and particularly in Cameron's speech to the House of Commons, I got no sense that he had taken into consideration what are known technically, and they are very important factors, as second and third line strategic consequences. If you bomb Assad's forces or assets, you're in a different kind of war. What kind of war are you going to win? Where does that war expand to? What are your acts and debts, your attachments and detachments? What are your allies? What is your objective? Strategy, it shouldn't be called strategy, because actually what the great father of it all in our time, von Clausewitz, was talking about is policy. And policies adjust according to the facts on the ground. And we've got two a prime minister and a president who are particularly bad at doing that. And he and Cameron, Obama and Cameron, are being driven by events. We can see it by the hour at the moment. There seems to be in their cabinet, in their private offices, in their think tanks, there is no anticipation of events. We got, I've been writing a lot about this today, we got once Mosul fell so dramatically earlier in the summer to ISIS, as they were still calling themselves then, we got what I call the News News Brigade. We got MI6 and the CIA to some extent working through the usual channels, through media, through the BBC, their pals there saying, oh, ISIS is grossly exaggerated. This is just a horde of bandits. They couldn't run a province, let alone a state. absolutely beside the point. Look at the grip on imagination. Look on this wave of anger, which has gone throughout movements, particularly Islamic movements here, political Islamic movements in the region since the inception of that faith. And this is what is going on. And just to reiterate, both Obama's administration and team and Cameron's administration and team have completely underestimated. I almost wanted to do a George W. Bushism and say misunderestimated. you know, what is going on there? Your questioning is absolutely on the money because this is a longer commitment than anybody is prepared to hint from Washington and Whitehall publicly at the moment.
Well, to come back to you on that point, James, sure. how limited is Barack Obama in terms of what he can ask the American people at this point to put up with in Iraq? Because I'm sure, like his 330 million fellow Americans, Barack Obama was rather hoping, as of December 2011, they would never have to think about the place ever again.
Yeah, you're right. And again, I mean, Robert raises the spectre of George W. Bush. One of the things that W. put in place in Iraq prior to the Obama administration was a continual enforcing perspective, the idea that the Iraqis would allow the Americans to continue to stage American forces in just in case anything like this happened, so that they could be in ground, in situ, so they could respond to events. What happened? Barack Obama came in, and all of a sudden that agreement went away. He didn't enforce it, and the Iraqis basically kicked the Americans out. How far does he want to get involved? He's got a limited deployment of special advisors. We heard that expression being bandied around a couple of weeks or months ago. That's a terrible expression from American history. It has all spectres of the early days of Vietnam, for example.
You would think they'd call them something else at this point.
You really would. You know,
they?
Semantics count. And when you have an administration which is very finely tuned and legalistic and it's at focus, again, I come back to this idea they keep making grammatical errors and slips which have implications. I'm very surprised, you know, we're talking here about the fact that they've launched from carriers. In other words, they're using manned aircraft. It's fascinating in this area. We've been talking for so many years now about the use of targeted drones and laser-guided missiles, for example. And now we're back to aircraft again. And one wonders about the logistics of that. How far does he want to get involved? He wants to put his big toe in just enough so that he can show he's doing something without getting committed enough in case anything terrible happens between now and the midterms in November.
Robert Fox, on that point, how much difference ultimately can, you know, this has come up time and time again in various interventions, committing air power alone against what is basically improvised, semi-organized light infantry on the ground? How much damage can they really do to the Islamic State?
It's the ultimate sophisticated expression of asymmetric warfare, and it's an asymmetry that doesn't really work. Yeah. Just thinking very quickly, the idea that the British came up with when they were managing the protectorate very early on in Iraq, in its very early days, not long after independence in 1920, was they had to fight a huge, in two senses of the term, bloody great insurgency in 1920. And there was a famous account of this by Lieutenant General Sir Aylmer Haldane, who was a great pal of Churchill's, and Churchill had to fire him in the end for incompetence. But he says the only way to deal with Iraq, and it just had become Iraq at that time, was drop bombs with the RAF, which they did, bribe tribal chiefs, and when you can't, hang them, which was practice learnt from the Northwest Frontier. That is what is going on. Particularly where we're talking about where the Yazidis are in the mountains, this kind of pinpoint strike against mobile forces, which won't rely too much. The BBC talks all the time, sorry about going about the BBC, about heavy weaponry. There's very little heavy weaponry in this. They've got a spot or two of artillery and they can bash that, but they can melt away like the snows in winter.
One very quick point. It's fascinating. You're talking about asymmetrical warfare. When Bill Clinton first became president and you asked about Bosnia, he turned to his secretary, his chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who was Colin Powell at that point, and said, can we do some aerial bombardment? And Powell in his memoir says, there it is, the classic problem. We want to do something, not enough. Let's drop some bombs without hurting too many people. We are back to where we were, arguably, with Bosnia back in 1993.
We're going to take a short break now, but for those of you who haven't had yet your fill of intractable Middle Eastern conflict, we do have a treat for you on the other side of the break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, James Boyes and Robert Fox. When we return, we will be discussing the apparent resumption of hostilities in Gaza and trying to put the current Ebola virus outbreak into some sort of perspective.
All around the world at Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents, bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's just gone 18:21 here in London. Still with me are James Boyce and Robert Fox. And our hopes that the long-suffering people of Gaza might have been permitted to return to what remained of their neighbourhoods in relative peace were shattered this morning by the end of a 72-hour ceasefire. Hamas appear to have fired first and have launched dozens of rockets during the day, wounding two Israelis at last count. Israel has responded with customary severity, hitting 35 targets and killing at least one Palestinian, a 12-year-old boy in this instance. Robert, I'll ask you the obvious question first. Is there any point to any of this at this point from either side?
Funny enough, it's, when it comes to Gaza, I've been thinking of the analogies with the end of Mad July in 1914 and leading to the war and the Great War 100 years ago. And I'm amazed that when we had a lot of this thing about ceremony, much too much sentiment, not enough real fact, that nobody really went into the audit sheet of the Great War. It wasn't just suffering. It was industrial war on a scale unexpected. But the way it produced the Middle East, including three battles of Gaza.
Indeed.
I mean, a lot of what we've got there actually comes from all of that. And that's what leads me in. It's sorry to be so long-winded, do a bit of memory lane again. But Gaza has been intractable. It's always been a heavily populated point of ground. The Israelis, since the inception of the Israeli state, have never known what to do about it. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, said, "I wish it was on the other side of the moon," and wanted to hand it, indeed he succeeded in handing it over to Egypt. President Gamal Abdel Nasser equally took the same view, because Palestinians are Palestinians. They are Arabs. They are quite distinct. They are a distinct sense of community. And as we are picking up through all this suffering, they do have a high intelligentsia. Still, somehow you have articulate, cosmopolitan people at the top end, doctors doing incredible pieces of work. And it is the sense of identity that Hamas, when it grew up, and this is being forgotten in all of this, when it grew up in the early 1980s as Islamic resistance, it was absolutely core to the care of community at the local level through mosque. It then became very military, very violent, the military wing, as we know. But the idea that
with Hezbollah there in Lebanon as well, which ran a large social structure.
But then you get the Shia Sunni split and the Muslim Indeed. Brotherhood and so on. I don't want to make it too complicated. But what I'm trying to say about Hamas, which is not coming through, and Sir John Holmes, very distinguished director of intelligence, several time British ambassador, really spelled it out the other day. This has an historical credential. You can't just wish it away, which is what I think the heavy dose, the bombardment of Israeli propaganda is saying. Because the logic of what I understand in this diluvione, this flood of words that you get from the official Israeli spokesman, is that they're explaining away their actions. And if I can parse any sense of what they're saying, it leads to two things. It leads to eradicating Hamas, which is going to be very, very difficult indeed, and occupying the Gaza Strip again. And I think very few in Israel want it. So in a very long-winded way, apologise again, I'm answering your question. Yes, it is leading to, on both sides, both Hamas and the Israeli side, to a logical absurdity.
James, to sort of turn this around to your area of expertise, sure. which is the American perspective on this, do you get the sense that Barack Obama has pretty much given up on this one as well?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't think he was really that involved in it. I don't think Barack Obama's ever laid awake at night thinking, you know, what am I going to do about those poor Palestinians?
Because he already had his Nobel Peace Prize.
You literally took the words right out of my mouth. You can only get it once. Let's be honest about it. John Kerry's going for that prize. I think he realises that they're not going to give it to an administration twice. Look, Kerry's got his hands full. He's running around the world. I'm kind of surprised that, you know, I've never been a great fan of this administration, but give him credit for one thing. When Hillary came in as sex stat, she did put some very credible people in as emissaries, people like the late lamented Richard Holbrooke, for example, in the AFPAC region, people like George Mitchell trying to sort out that part of the world. There was at least an attempt, I think, to focus upon it. Now, it didn't work. And Obama's suggestion that he could deliver peace in the Middle East, if you remember this, in 12 months, it sounds, you know, as ludicrous.
He'd been reading Joe Nye too much.
Oh, my goodness, my goodness, my goodness. There's no doubt about it. I mean, some of your listeners might have heard my darling wife on this channel this morning on The Globalist talking about this, and as a fellow at LSE's Middle East Centre, I defer to her. You know, her line is quite simple on this, which is that, frankly, it's in no side's interest to back down at this point. Netanyahu can't seem to be backing down in the face of continual missile strikes from Hamas, and if Hamas give way, they start the low, slow march to political oblivion, especially considering the long-standing tensions between them and the Fatah movement in the West Bank. So
and the Sisi regime in Egypt. They're
caught between not quite Iraq and a hard place, they're getting that way.
Finally, then, on that cheerful thought, we will saddle up another of the four horsemen. The current outbreak of the Ebola virus has now killed at least 960 people in West Africa. It's the first outbreak of the disease in West Africa, and it's the worst ever recorded anywhere. Additionally, suspected cases borne by international air travel have been reported in Nigeria and Saudi Arabia. The World Health Organization, not unreasonably, has declared this an international health emergency. Robert, I'll ask you first, how much of the international reaction to this? We've seen embassies being closed, flights being suspended, personnel being withdrawn, tourists being warned off. How much of this is prudence and how much of it's panic?
I think by and large it's prudence, actually. And I think a lot of the academic, hands-on academic medical experience that's been shared through media and advice has been very good. And I think Dr. Chan, Margaret Chan, the Director General of the WHO, she gave a video broadcast for world distribution saying, look, this is a global issue. I'm not saying it's going to go to every country in the world, but we now have the very likely prospect that we won't be able to contain it to Africa. Therefore, we've got to concentrate on immediate healthcare intervention, education, and quarantine regime. Absolutely commonsensical. In fact, it was exemplary of how to give a very serious public warning statement. But the bit that worries me, and it's very much the territory in which James and I operate, we have seen laundry lists now for two decades at least, in national security strategies. And it happened in the British National Security Strategy of October 2010 and both in the Obama and in the Bush national security strategies. Oh, by the way, we might have a pandemic. And they were thinking in terms of SARS and bird flu. Because of the impact, because of the extremely vulnerable communities in which this is operating, this is the real deal. It's not, oh, bloody, bloody, blah, the academics say we'd better put this on the national security laundry list.
Because
this is real, and we're going to have to think about it in the future. Because the bit that I would like to mention only in a stage whisper is that if some of these things, I don't say it happens with Ebola, but could mutate and could get into the hands of the wrong people, that is going to be one of the new dimensions of asymmetric conflict, which states are going to find very hard to handle.
James Boyce, what have you made of the press coverage of this? Because there is, without downplaying the seriousness of this, many other diseases kill many more people, dengue fever, malaria, measles. And the British press in particular, I do think, especially usually around this time of year, does enjoy a good health scare, whether it is bird flu, swine flu, SARS, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, come on, the tabloid press, once every week.
What have you made of it this time?
It's quite remarkable, isn't it? I think we're in that silly season, as you rightly point out, where it's, the Parliament's in recess. What are we going to focus upon? There's also the idea that, this starts to sound awful awful lot like some storyline to all too many bad Hollywood movies. You know, let's bring Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie in here and we can find the solution in 5 minutes, no doubt. If I was American, I'd be a bit concerned that certain people are being flown back to the United States for treatment. Certainly that doesn't seem to be a particularly wise move. I would think quarantine this at source rather than take them back into the continental United States. Who the hell am I to decide what US foreign policy is? But it certainly wouldn't be something I'd be advocating.
Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there. James Boyce and Robert Fox, thank you both very much for joining us. There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the second half hour of the program, we will speak to our man in Belgrade. We'll review the latest films and we'll talk to the author Lawrence Gonzalez about his new book about the 1989 Flight 232 disaster. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. US warplanes have today bombed Islamist fighters marching on Iraq's Kurdish capital. Islamic State fighters who have beheaded and crucified captives in their drive to eradicate unbelievers have advanced to within half an hour's drive of Arbil, a hub for US oil companies. Israel has launched airstrikes across the Gaza Strip on Friday in response to Palestinian rockets after Egyptian-mediated talks failed to extend a 72-hour truce in a month-long war. Countries around the world have been put on alert as the World Health Organization declares the Ebola outbreak in West Africa an international public health emergency. 961 people have now died since the outbreak started in February. And the Ukrainian Prime Minister said on Friday that the government has prepared a list of sanctions which target 172 citizens from Russia and other countries and 65 Russian companies who were financing, as he put it, terrorism in Ukraine. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's now 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London. That's 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're going to Belgrade, from where we're joined by Guy Delaunay. Guy, welcome to the show. Serbia, close to Russia, both geographically and politically, and if I'm going to turn the both into a three there, spiritually as well. How does the Russian ban on EU or imported food affect them?
Orthodox brothers effect, isn't it? And in this case, it's Serbia's having its cake and eating it, literally and metaphorically, I think you could say, because of course Russia's banned all these agricultural products from the European Union. Serbia, not yet a member of the European Union, though it is on the membership path. Formal negotiations and the accession process actually started earlier in this year. And so far, Serbia's managing a decent juggling act, and it's particularly delicious this week, if you'll pardon the use of the word, because while countries like Croatia and Montenegro, which, although it isn't an EU member, has joined in the EU sanctions against Russia, have had this ban slapped on them by Russia, Serbia hasn't, because it didn't join in the sanctions in the first place. And now, of course, Serbia, being a primarily agricultural country, is looking around, licking its lips, saying, well, if Croatia and Montenegro can't export to Russia anymore, that could be an opportunity for us.
You mentioned there, though, that there is a juggling act, in that while Serbia can obviously see a huge commercial opportunity here because it can sell food to Russians that the EU countries cannot anymore, Serbia does, of course, as you pointed out, want to join the EU at some point. So which team do they pick here?
It's really, really tricky. I mean, they are coming under heavy manners from Brussels at all points to join in with the EU in its line on Russia and on the Ukraine. But what Serbia has managed to do, and so far fairly effectively, is say that, well, while we think that Crimea should remain part of Ukraine, we're not going to throw away our friendship with Russia, and therefore we can't impose any sanctions. And it would be economic suicide for Serbia to impose sanctions on Russia, frankly. I think it's number four in its list of export earners, the exports that Serbia makes to Russia. It's one of its biggest trading partners. It's also one of the biggest investors in Serbia. And they've got the South Stream pipeline, which is under construction in Serbia, obviously part of a great Russian project. Why would Serbia possibly act against its national interests in this way for jam tomorrow? And not jam tomorrow, but jam in 2020 if you're lucky.
We will look further afield now to the Western Balkans, which suffered from dreadful flooding earlier this year, but appear to be in for a repeat dose.
Absolutely. It's been completely bizarre the way the summer has gone in the Balkans. Normally, as you know, Andrew, it's quite hot and heavy here during the summer.
Extremely so.
Absolutely. Temperatures pushing the 40s, sun cracking the flags, all the rest of it. This year, it's been a series of electrical storms, massive downpours. And of course, in places which aren't equipped for that sort of weather, there's been floods again. In Serbia, one of the major power stations was inundated in the past week. In Bosnia, they've had a repeat of the landslides, which they had in May when the very much more significant floods came in. And all of this has added to the woe of people who were only just not even really getting back on their feet, but certainly coming to terms with what happened to them a couple of months ago.
What are people learning about the preparedness and performance of their governments for such things? There was quite a lot of anger in May. Is that manifesting again?
Not quite yet. What we've had is the donors conference, which took place in Brussels a couple of weeks ago, at which a number of countries pledged great deals of money towards the countries which have suffered in all of this. But, you know, this is a new thing for everybody to deal with. It's not as if it was entirely predictable. And you see this, for example, in the country I used to live in, Cambodia, they were experiencing increased numbers of extreme weather events, as the official jargon puts it, that they hadn't been prepared for. A lot of people would describe this as climate change, and it's something, a new paradigm that people are going to have to get used to. And I think that gets people a lot of forgiveness in the Balkans, because this is so weird. How could you prepare for something, and why should you prepare for something that you didn't know was going to happen and you thought extremely unlikely to happen?
Finally, I wanted to talk about, it seems like an unusual idea, a heartwarming story from Srebrenica, which of course remains one of the most infamous names on the map of Europe.
And this is about an ethnically mixed choir, a children's choir from Srebrenica. And of course, when you consider the ethnic hatred and the ethnic massacre that took place in Srebrenica less than 20 years ago, to have anything that's ethnically integrated seems like a small miracle. And in this case, this choir, Supera, they're called, more than 100 children, all aged 14 or under, have got together, and they have a music school in Srebrenica, and they've recorded a single to in aid of flood relief. They're trying to buy instruments for music schools in flood affected areas, not just in Bosnia but also in Croatia and Serbia as well. And so, you know, trying to send a message that, hey, if we can get together and put aside our differences and help other people out, then there's hope for humanity yet.
Well, because we should point out that 20 years later, notwithstanding, that part of Bosnia is still extremely ethnically divided. What brought this project about? How and who was, by whom was it made to happen?
A lot of it was influenced from an Austrian humanitarian called Dobraja Eberle, who has a foundation called Farmers Help Farmers, and she's been involved in Srebrenica for more than 20 years. And she came up with this idea of music schools, having seen something similar in Venezuela, and found local people very happy to help. There's a choir master who's from Brčko, which is another very much affected area, called Isma Parlic, and he's been very enthusiastic about the whole project and talks about how, well, you know, this isn't at any point about anybody being separate. It's about people getting together, having fun, doing music, and, you know, gaining skills which will benefit them later in life. And both of them are very much asked them, you know, aren't you hoping for a little too much from this project? You've got a choir here. It's not going to change the world, but they have very high hopes that it will affect the wider community, not just in Srebrenica, but further afield in Bosnia as well.
I mean, it is kids singing on the track, which is called Love People, and it is being sold to attract donations to music schools in flood-affected areas of the Balkans. Do we know what effect it's had on the communities as a whole? Are their parents now speaking to each other?
Anna, that's the interesting thing. I mean, the children, of course, are completely unfazed by all of this. You talk to them and you say, well, you know, wasn't it a big step for you getting in an ethnically mixed choir? And they just shrug their shoulders and say, doesn't mean anything to us. But for their parents, of course, it was much more of a big deal. And the key to all of this is, of course, when you've got children singing in a choir, you'll have parents taking them to rehearsals, picking them up, going to the performances. And what they found initially was the parents weren't mixing at all. So they did a very simple thing. It's almost like David Cameron's nudge unit. They put a coffee machine and an ashtray in the middle of the room. And because people in the Balkans love nothing more than to drink coffee and smoke, they gathered around the coffee machine and had some fags. And now they're talking to each other and apparently say that's the first time they've been able to be proud of their children together.
All concerned can only be wished well with that. Guy Delaunay speaking to us from Belgrade there. Thanks very much, as ever, for joining us. Up next, we'll be talking to Lawrence Gonzalez about his new book about the Flight 232 air disaster of 1989.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world.
The protesters on the street are doing all of this in order to try and get the military to take over and to declare an emergency and basically start something that looks like a coup in order to get the current government out of power.
Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
And of course, a Monocle editor drops into the studio to review the papers across North and South America. That's a briefing every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, it is a nightmare which will have occurred to even the most sanguine frequent flyer, finding oneself aboard an irrecoverably stricken aircraft faced with agonising minutes in which to prepare for a crash. Few who know the feeling live to tell about it, but 184 of the 296 people aboard United Airlines Flight 232 from Denver to Chicago on July 19th, 1989, do. They survived the DC-10's crash landing at Sioux City, prompted by an engine failure at 37,000 feet. Flight 232 is now the subject of a book by the same name, by Lawrence Gonzalez, who joins me now. Lawrence, first of all, why this flight? Of all the air disasters there have been, what drew you to this one to investigate in this detail?
Well, you just said it. Most of the time when we have a crash of this magnitude, everyone is dead, and we never get to find out what happened inside the plane. In this case, 184 people were still there to talk about it, and I was able to interview many of them, along with everyone else concerned with this crash, investigators, firefighters, etc., to do a complete 360-degree reconstruction of this incredible event in history.
How willing or otherwise did you find people to talk about it? Was there a big variation in responses when you asked people?
Almost everyone wanted to talk. There were a few exceptions of people who just were too emotionally affected by it. But almost everyone wanted to talk. And I think at the time of the crash, they didn't much want to talk to reporters, certainly. But after 20 years had gone by, a lot of them felt the need to unburden themselves at last.
You've put together a very detailed reconstruction of those minutes in between realizing that the plane has a problem and the plane crash landing. And it is and I kind of mean this as a compliment, it's so detailed that it's actually quite difficult to read in parts. I speak as an intermittently nervous flyer there myself. Were you surprised by anything you learned about how people acted when they were told this plane is going to crash?
Yes, most of them remained calm. There were some exceptions. There were some people who were crying and had to be comforted by the flight attendants. Most people were calm, and they made plans, and they tried to think through what they would do. There were a number of women who put their driver's licenses down into their bras to help identify them because they thought they were going to die. Many people were holding hands and praying, others were simply trying to comfort other people who were afraid. There were some people on board who thought the plane wouldn't ever crash.
Do you think that that calmness says anything about humans' reaction to mortal fear, or was it mostly governed by the way that the crew handled the situation?
Well, I think the crew did an exemplary job, certainly, in helping to keep people calm. But I think that, you know, one of the things that several people told me as the plane was crashing, they felt this overwhelming sense of calm and peacefulness. Even one woman who was engulfed in a fireball said, you know, at that moment, I just felt so peaceful, I couldn't even describe it. So there's a kind of a paradoxical reaction to extreme danger sometimes.
Did any of the people you spoke to sort of talk with remorse or guilt about how they'd reacted? You know, a kind of feeling that at a moment of that sort of supreme test, they just weren't up to it?
No, I think that what I did hear was guilt at surviving, survivor's guilt, as they call it. People who walked away from it without a scratch and then saw people with terrible losses and terrible injuries and thought, well, why me? Why was I saved? And I think some people struggled a lot to come to terms with that. And many people, most people actually that I interviewed, went on with their lives successfully. And as I say, there are a few exceptions.
Did writing this book and sort of like hearing so much about this one particular accident, has it sort of, have you found it affecting your own views about getting on aeroplanes at all?
I feel safer than ever getting on an airplane, having written this book, because I know so much about the techniques and technologies involved, and flying is the safest way to travel, safer than walking down the street, statistically. And I don't worry at all about being in a plane crash. It's just that no one had ever attempted the complete reconstruction of an aviation accident of this magnitude before. There are plenty of maritime stories like the Titanic where you get this complete reconstruction of what happened minute by minute. And yet no one had ever tried that with the crash of a fully loaded jumbo jet. So that was one of my challenges in doing this. But it's really a human story. I mean, the people involved were just so generous and heroic and resilient. It gives me new faith in humanity.
But the thing is, though, we still haven't quite come to terms with it, I don't think, as a species, have we? The idea of flying through the sky at 1,000 kilometres an hour, because what you say there is absolutely true. Measured against every other form of transport, it's incredibly safe. I mean, I can remember earlier this year being in a backfiring taxi with no seatbelts, being driven along an unlit highway in West Africa towards an airport and realising it's the plane I'm worried about. But nonetheless, there's a reason why we're still so gripped, I think, by air disasters. We're still at some level really not used to the idea.
Well, it's an alien environment, and you lose all the normal cues that you have that tell you you're okay. As you say, as an animal, you're viewing your environment and checking signals to see, am I okay? And all around you, there are these things that tell you you're standing upright and you're breathing air, and you go into the stratosphere, all those cues are gone. And moreover, you don't have any control. And I think we dislike that the most.
I think it is. I think that's the control thing is exactly it. I think you've hit the nail on the head precisely. But in a situation like the one you describe, where even the captain of the aircraft has extremely limited control over what's going on, how does he cope with dealing with that, which you would think would be more than enough, and communicating what's going on to the passengers? How much or how little did he tell them?
Well, at the very end, he tried to tell them in no uncertain terms that this was going to be bad. He said, I'm not going to kid you. And then he told them that it was going to be the worst landing they'd ever been through and maybe even worse than that, and they had to be prepared. So he didn't say, we're going to crash, but he said everything just short of that. But, I mean, he did a spectacular job. Captain Al Haynes really saved those lives in the seconds after that engine exploded and should be commended for it. Any other plane that lost all its hydraulics in the previous 25 years before that had crashed, killing all aboard. So this is, again, a unique a unique accident and a uniquely human story.
It is an extraordinary story, and it's a very well-told one, although I would counsel listeners against reading it the day before they fly anywhere. Lawrence Gonzalez, author of Flight 232, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back. It's time now for a bit of music. We shall shortly be discussing the week's new films, one of which does concern the hunt for a T-Rex relic. So here's exactly that.
Ride it all out like a bird in the skywards. Ride it all out like you were a bird. Fly it all out like an eagle in a sunbeam. Ride it all out like you were a bird.
T-Rex with Ride a White Swan, the reasons for which will become clear imminently. We are coming up for the end of today's show, which means it's time for our daily review of some or other field of the arts. Today we're talking film, and joining me to tell us whether we should be buying popcorn or tomatoes is the film critic Tim Robey. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
First, you wanted to discuss, this is Hong Kao's new film, Lilting, which I'm gathering from what I've seen of it, it features few car chases.
Not many car chases, yes. Quite a lot of grief-stricken talks in small rooms. Ben Whishaw is the star and is excellent in it. I think it's, in fact, probably his best performance on film, or at least certainly his best since he played John Keats. It's a very low-budget film. It's set up by this funding scheme called Microwave, which Film London have, which stipulates a maximum budget of £120,000. That's all you get.
Which is astonishingly little money to make a film with.
Very little. And they managed to make Shifty a few years ago with that budget, and this is the latest. It's Hong Kao's debut feature, and it's a very kind of diligent and sensitive piece of work. Whishaw plays a young gay man who's recently lost his boyfriend in a tragic accident, and his boyfriend is Chinese Singaporean, and his boyfriend's mother has been moved into a nursing home in London, and they have a very kind of hostile relationship. She doesn't really understand she doesn't know that her son was gay. So to her, the Whishaw character is kind of like this best friend who then turns up and starts trying to help her. They don't develop much rapport at first. She has no English as well. So it's sort of about the claims of a dead person on different people after they die.
Okay, we have a clip from that.
I tried telling her. My heart was pounding so fast.
What are your true intentions?
I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to help you get out of this awful place.
She says she can still smell Kai in your room.
Me too. I smell him too. I know you miss him. I don't know what to do. I miss him tremendously.
A clip there from Hong Kao's Lilting. It is, as you say, a film largely of people being grief-stricken in small, dark rooms, which means that the writing and the acting both have to be absolutely superb to carry it off, are they?
I think the acting is superb, particularly from Whishaw. Like I say, I feel as though he's given his best performances on stage so far. His Hamlet springs to mind. And Keats was an exception, but his film work has been a little bit patchy here and there. This performance, the film is kind of constructed very well to let him do a certain type of sensitivity very well. I found him really moving in it and quite convincing. I think the problem with Jun, his kind of counterpart in the film, is that because as a non-Chinese speaker, I'm not able to hear her speak in her own words, we get much less of a window on that character. I don't feel as though that portrait works quite as well. And the film is sort of doing some clever things, juggling time a bit and bringing back the dead character Kai in flashback as a sort of a ghostly figure who comes in and talks to them both. And I feel as though that's all very kind of carefully weighted, and, you know, it's slightly It's getting marks all the way through for kind of due care and diligence, but not necessarily taking it to that next level where you really feel this has hit me in the gut.
Okay. Well, I want to talk now about it's a documentary, and it's the reason we played the song we played on our way in here. This is Dinosaur 13, and it is a documentary about people, well, finding a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Now, I'm sold right there. This is people looking for a massive dinosaur. How is this not going to be good? Is it?
It really is. I saw this one this morning and I knew nothing about it. I actually didn't even know it was a documentary. And it's tremendous. So this is something that happened in 1990. It's about a very small outfit of paleontologists from South Dakota, I believe, who discover this kind of enormous and unprecedentedly well-preserved dinosaur fossil kind of in the desert. They stumble upon it and they think, wow, this is going to make our careers. They set about very carefully preserving it, sort of digging away around it. It takes them, I think, 17 days on the actual site to kind of like remove enough rock that they can actually remove the fossil, pack it up, get it ready, take it back to their little museum, where they continue to spend another whole year preparing it. And then, after a year, the federal government pounces on them and takes it away and says, you weren't allowed to have this. This belongs on American land.
We have a clip from this.
We were riding on top of the world. We had everything going for us. Less than a week after that, all hell broke loose. We were met by two FBI agents with a search warrant to take Sue and all records belonging to Sue. But they took everything. People were so emotionally involved. There was a dream that the town had. It was our dinosaur. It was our lives that had been torn to pieces.
When you make the most fantastic discovery, a lot of people want a piece of it.
That from Dinosaur 13, Todd Douglas Miller's chronicle of the 1990 hunt for the largest ever T-Rex. Just finally, before you go, Tim, we need to talk about Welcome to New York, a dramatization of the rather disreputable and, well, actually I can't do better than that, antics of Dominique Strauss-Kahn in New York in 2011.
Yeah, perfect casting here. Gérard Depardieu at his most kind of elephantine and grunting and slightly gross as Strauss-Kahn. It's thinly disguised. They call him Devereaux to sort of for legal reasons to sort of try and dodge away from lawsuits, but they've faced lawsuits nonetheless because it's clearly Indeed. Based on DSK and Jacqueline Bisset as his wife. So this is Abel Ferrara, the kind of great kind of, you know, hefty, macho, maverick filmmaker of American fame, who's taken this on. And to begin with, it's really provocative and kind of funny, actually. It's kind of hilarious. The first 20 minutes in which you just basically get a series of Depardieu orgies. Sounds like the most grotesque thing you've ever seen, and kind of is, and it's also sort of hilarious. And then the kind of procedural bits where he actually gets arrested are quite well done. I feel as though the film falls apart in the second half, though.
Tim Roby, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our in particular to our earlier special guests, James Boyes and Robert Fox. The show was produced by Isabel Kaiser, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Matilda Ivy. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Up after the headlines at 1900 hours is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Daily. This show returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.